Going into this recording today, I had been preparing with the wrong episode and was like, I have to emotionally steel myself for certain events, which happened to be actually from another chapter. But now I'm like, no, we're just into the parts of the book where like every chapter has these emotional notes of like profound relational depth in ways that like when seen within the context of the story, like hello, did you think that your heart was beating normally? We're just gonna punch it and it's gonna beat so deeply in your chest that you need to take a solid breath just to realize how big your chest is.
You're listening to Nun Pod with Left Grief. Bonus episode 2. The COVID ending.
If you were, you could be an adept or a sword fighter, necro or cav, and you needed to build trust with your partner, what would your 8 hours of sleep a night be?
Like the bargain that I would strike between myself and my counterpart.
If you were in this position that Harrow and Gideon are in now, where Harrow's like, I cannot be a stranger to you, and Gideon's like, I need to fucking trust you. And Harrow's like, what is a material thing that I can do that is meaningful to build that trust? What would your 8 hours of sleep be?
I simply would not have put myself in this position because I would have honored my partner's autonomy already.
I love that. Yeah, that's one answer. Kit, what's your answer?
As a self-aware individual, I likely would have violated my partner's autonomy at this point, especially if I were in specifically Harrow and Gideon's position, as I know and in my heart I would be an adept, and I would likely be in a very like one-to-one kind of thing of there is too much to see, we do not have time for other things. That's so hard. I feel like sleep is a great place to start because it's just a, it's so it's such a basic need. I think it would depend so heavily on who my cavalier was. Like if it was my partner, who is a total jock cavalier, and I do believe would be like we've joked about me being an adept and them being a cavalier before. They're also a lot like Gideon. It would probably be some sort of like you get to go work out with everyone. You get to go have your fun gym time in the morning, and then we gotta lock in because I understand it's like you gotta like do what you came here to do, and there's like a social aspect, like a social capital to be playing with these like nobles. I think that you can discover a lot by like playing a little, sword fighting. Like Gideon discovered a lot in that chapter, I think, about the other houses and the dynamics that she wasn't privy to before. So
Claire, what's yours?
And as a at least in the context of this conversation, a Gideon archetype type person, this kind of affects the plot. Don't let me justify hurting myself for the sake of the cause. I will have and will probably continue my life, apply too much force to an effort and injure myself unnecessarily to try and get something done because I'm a passionate person. And I think the difference here is the unnecessarily caveat, but later on in this book, when Gideon does indeed harm herself for the sake of getting something done, one could argue that was not unnecessarily, but I still think the part where like I was recently like play wrestling with a partner and re-injured my hands because I was gripping too forcefully in a way that was like not necessary for the game. So yeah, as a cavalier, I would ask that they not let me initiate a situation that would lead to undue, unhelpful injury. Because I was too passionate in applying myself.
That's fair. I kind of
I need
forgot that it was about
limits,
trust.
and I want those limits respected and supported, even if the thing pushing my limits is myself.
Gideon being able to do this and the entire time easily being able to stop it and not stopping it is like so telling, I feel like, about Gideon in general, which like we get this aspect of her in different ways. You know, she's like vow of silence. She's sticking to that despite crazy circumstances and stuff like that. But like she's got a
Except for sometimes.
crazy, except for sometimes, but she's got a
These are
wild degree of self-control.
my relationship with pain is one where it's like, cool, I'm gonna win.
Yeah.
That's not how pain works. There's a kind of like idea that if you let something decide how you're going to respond to it, you inherently lose all control over your life. And so I think a lot, the thing that I find really relatable there is like Gideon's agency is about she gets to control how she responds. She doesn't get to control her life, what she's doing, how people treat her, but she can control how she. What she feels about herself and how her body responds to things. And that is where like she gets choice and no one can take that away from her. And so in her saying yes, okay, like she's like, I said yes to Harrow and I'm gonna get Harrow to get through this. And because it is as much about Gideon's sense of survival of her own like system of understanding herself and surviving her life as it is the commitment to Harrow.
I would imagine her like fitness stuff is probably a lot about that too. Like back on the ninth, like she's doing hundreds of sit-ups every day, you know? She's like extremely fit in a way that suggests that that's very much like a coping mechanism for the lack of control that she has over everything else.
Yeah, I also have a very unusual and not super healthy relationship with pain because I have a very low pain threshold. So I am not able to benefit from pain as a signal of injury. And what that means is something can hurt a lot, and I don't know if that means that I'm seriously injured. And so I'm really used to ignoring pain and just coping with it. And what that has meant is that I routinely will shrug off serious injury. I broke a rib in a fight and kept fighting. And it wasn't the kind of fight that I couldn't get out of. It was practice. It was fun. And it turned out that, yeah, I had broken a rib and dislocated a rib. And I didn't get medical treatment because it always hurts to be in a fight. That's just part of what being in a fight is like.
That's so interesting because I have a high pain threshold and I have kind of the exact same problem for the same reason. So that makes perfect sense. Like, if you can't trust where your pain is at to match up to, oh no, then it's just useless information
And I think there's a
and you ignore
piece
it.
there that's not just your relationship to your own pain, but it's how people recognize you experiencing it. Like, if you're experiencing pain and it's not, you know, recognized and acknowledged and given time to be processed, like mentally and emotionally, you learn that the way to respond to it is to keep doing the thing. And like treating pain in children is an ongoing developing discipline because of the way that pain is not recognized and not acknowledged in children's experiences.
And
And
I think
so
the overwhelming, like the common advice for parents is like, oh, don't react too much to it, or else they'll like make it a bigger deal with like, I don't like, maybe that's not true, or maybe we're just teaching kids to not react to pain. I don't know.
Well, and it's an interesting thing too, because like Gideon was not raised in an environment where any compassion towards her physical experience would have been given. But also, like children are not given space or agency to decide where their limits are in a lot of ways. Like if a child is hurting in a way that leads them to an amount of distress that they can no longer socially function, which like in the early years doesn't take a lot. Like you can fall down and skin your knee and it's the worst thing that's ever happened to you since you've been born. And that is like a mentally altering amount of pain. But in the context of the adults around you, they see this as less than consequential, but it does set precedents for how you're supposed to respond to your own body's signals.
That's true.
So you have to, you know, really document those patterns later on in life when you have the language to, or else it can lead to, as we've all articulated here, ways of ignoring that signal that have very real and long-term consequences.
Yeah, and it seems like the signal itself can get kind of jumbled too, probably.
It's so interesting to me that having pain be calibrated up or down has sort of the same effect clinically.
Yeah. Like it's
Like,
functionally the same thing. I would imagine yours is less pleasant, so
I
that's
don't care
unfortunate.
though, honestly.
Yeah,
Like,
fair.
because I'm used to being in pain, and so like I it almost wraps back around because like I will sometimes wade into seeing people have discourse about people who say that tattoos don't hurt.
I don't find that they hurt.
I don't find that they hurt.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
My most recent tattoo, I actually only didn't take a nap during it because I felt like that would be rude. I was vibing. I was having a fine time. And it's not that it doesn't do pain, it's that it doesn't do a level of pain that rates.
Interesting.
If I couldn't sleep through pain, I wouldn't sleep at all.
And that's a that that's a that's something that would be so interesting to like be able to jump into somebody else's body and compare. Because now I'm questioning, like, do I actually have a high pain threshold, or am I just ignoring it until it gets to a certain, like, I don't know.
Yeah, and I have found there's a real choice to the relationship for me, where it's like when I choose to respond to it is very strategic, and how I choose to respond to it is very strategic, and how I experience it after that choice changes.
And it's also a little bit of how you define the ex the like sensory experience that you're having. Like I know when you're prepping to give birth, a lot of things that they'll tell you is like, don't think about it as its pain, think about it as its intensity. And like
Or pressure.
different, yeah, exactly. And it like it does make a difference in my experience that like, yeah, if you're defining it differently, you experience it differently a lot of times.
Myself and a friend of mine have been talking to another friend who is like expecting a baby in February. And my friend has given birth. I've worked as a doula, so we're kind of sharing our knowledge base, and it is interesting, like, as you develop more nuanced languages for sensation, you're able to develop, like, similarly to how children can only process emotions with the limited amount of language they have available to them, we can only process pain in the amount of language we have to articulate that pain to ourselves. Or, pain is one word. Now we have pressure. Now we have tension. Now we have extension. Now we have intensity. Now we have like tingling. Now we have burning. Like, these words start to create nuance of like, oh, like I was sitting in the bath once and I was like, why is my ass burning? It's because I put like cinnamon oil on the bottom of the bathtub before I poured the water in. I ended up
Oops.
with fucking blisters on my ass,
Oh
but it was like a very interesting moment because I was like, something's wrong.
no.
Something's wrong. Something's wrong in a very specific way, and I don't understand it because it was a kind of pain that I had never experienced before.
Yeah.
It was a slow chemical burn.
A new sensation. How exciting.
And
That's like experiencing nausea is like, I feel like when I was a kid, my tummy hurt. Whereas now I don't experience nausea as like pain at all.
because I have chronic pain and because I have a low pain threshold, I think that there's a lot of levels of things that are pain that I just sort of don't talk about as pain because in order to be described as pain for me, it has to hit at least a three or a four. Anything less than that just doesn't count.
Yeah.
And people who don't experience chronic pain often tend to react very differently to hearing about people's experiences of pain, which, like, saying that Gideon experiences chronic pain, I think, like, or Gideon probably frames her experiences of pain pretty similarly to those people who have chronic pain, which is a kind of like, yeah, that happened. And also, I put on shoes.
It's
Like,
just part of life. It's a
yeah.
Tuesday.
Yeah, I find Gideon's response to pain really relatable in that way. Like last year or the year before, I hit a nine in the middle of class, and that is notable. A nine on the functional pain scale, which goes to 10, is you cannot think about anything else but pain. I think Gideon's at a 10 here.
Yes.
It doesn't get worse than this. You can't get in more pain than Gideon is experiencing in this scene.
Guy Gabriel K has this wonderful mechanism that I would, if you guys know of any fanfic written from this perspective, where he will take like a basically a bystander, a witness, someone who observes the main cast in their journey, only for a moment. And there's this one where this girl talks about telling the story to her grandchildren years later, which is a really interesting way of like thinking of these stories of like some of these, you know, in Nona we have characters who have a long history of knowledge of the story, and we see a little bit about how that affects their present experience. And I love that's one of the reasons why I like Nona, is because we have an even broader cast in a way through I mean Pyrrha is the favorite to, you know, pick to explain this, but
But like that story is a nightmare when you think about it from Hot Sauce's perspective.
But I would love to read Hot Sauce's perspective as much as I don't necessarily like reading horror stories. I adore that child and would love to hear her experience.
And of course, to also address the proverbial elephant in the room that is always present when we talk about Locke's tomb, Homestuck does this exact same thing. And of a large cast of characters that revolve around the same very massive event happening in their lives. And they are all, like, at least the main cast members slash the narrators of the story are all at a very impressionable age where you do feel like you can do anything. Like, all the characters in Homestuck are meant to be like 12, 13. I think it's a very interesting thing. A lot of people don't like to give Homestuck the nuance that it deserves, but
I read Homestuck back like through 2005. Like I accidentally came upon it, and it's an interesting thing to think about, like that age, because I had like just moved out of home. A lot of things were transitioning in my life, and there's that combination of you think you can do anything, but you're also like fighting to claim agency and power in the world that has prior in your life you've never really been aware of, and you're starting to see, you know, where you can claim power that is truly yours, where you can claim a voice that is truly yours. And there's a real hunger in that, I think, as well, that drives, you know, both that younger age, but I think the characters in the story as we're currently reading it now.
absolutely. There's an excerpt that Andrew Hussey, the creator of Homestuck, talks about one of the characters, well, the main character, John, and how through the entire, like, I think first four acts, he's looking for his dad in this, like, new universe that has been created. And the whole point is that, of course, I'm gonna spoil Homestuck. Either you haven't read it right now because you don't care about Homestuck, or you've had your chance. It's okay. He never finds his dad, and it's essentially this very large form metaphor of how he wasn't looking for his dad because he wants his dad, the person. He was looking for the person that can make him feel like a kid again when he has somehow found, like, stumbled across a massive amount of responsibility very suddenly, and now he craves, like, ignorance again. And how he'll never have it again because he cannot find his dad. He cannot ever be his parents' child again because he no longer has his parent.
I would love to see John and Nona talk about that.
Of all of the characters that you could do a one-to-one analysis of with, like, Locke's Tomb and Homestuck, like, of course, Dave and Gideon and Rose and Harrow, John is one that sticks out kind of like a sore thumb. Like, there's no one-to-one with John really until you get to Nona, in which it's like, yeah, this constant pursuit of, like, of reclaiming an innocence that you never really realized you lost, I think, because, you know, Nona always wanted to be, like, grown up in Nona. But now we're talking about Nona, and I don't want to, we're getting ahead of ourselves. We're still in Gideon the Ninth.
So, speaking of skulls.
I don't know if I've mentioned it on the podcast so far, but for a very long time, I liked to pitch this book to people as it's a lot like a Scooby-Doo episode because I love a cruel yet hilarious misdirect.
It's true, the Hungry Ghosts turned out to be, I mean, not a local capitalist, I guess, but
Someone of cruel power.
I think that's a lot more accurate than the typical lesbian necromancers in space
It's more
to
fun.
me. It is.
It's more fun, and that's why I do it.
No, that's good. I like that.
But it's interesting that like these books aren't often portrayed as mystery, despite that being like an extremely core part of this book genre.
I usually describe Gideon as a murder mystery and Harrow as a psychological horror.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I had no awareness of either of those things when I went into either of those books.
Oh,
And I
same. I
kind of
was just.
also enjoy the fact where it's like sword lesbians in space with necromancy. Like, it doesn't actually give you any idea about literary genre or writing style or anything like that. It just gives you a little bit of the palette. Like, and I do think maybe around like lesbians and sapphic tropes and that kind of thing, maybe there's a little bit of literary indication there, but generally you're like, I don't know what's going to happen. Is this going to be some kind of like romantic high fantasy? Like, no, it's a murder mystery, bitches. Buckle the fuck up. Like, there's going to be body horror.
I've heard this people describe Gideon the Ninth as like classic straight down the middle, kind of like swashbuckling high fantasy, and I'm like,
Did we read the
what
same
are
book?
you reading?
Like, I my high fantasy is like the Fionnuala Tapestries, which like has some serious swashbuckling in it, and it's nothing like Gideon the Ninth.
You know what I don't think of a lot when I read Gideon the Ninth is The Princess Bride.
I think if I had to pick any like fantasy or sci-fi that this reminds me of, it would be the Chronicles of Riddick.
What things are you paralleling there?
First of all, necromancers in space. We love it. Also, I feel like the mixture of fantasy and sci-fi is pretty similar, like the proportions of fantasy and sci-fi are pretty similar to me. It's like it's very much sci-fi because it's happening in space, but all of the things that are happening are generally pretty fantasy. Like, there's a lot of fantasy shit happening. It's just happening in space. So, but
You
also
know,
the necromancers are kind of a big part of it too.
technically all the fantasy happens in space.
Yeah, God, it's so true.
Okay, I just have lens flare.
Well, I mean, that makes it sci-fi, so
vibes.
The lens flare isn't gonna stop. That's just what we're doing now.
Well, lens flare will continue until morale improves. Okay. She was stroking Gideon's hair, and then afterwards she's like, nice hair. Did she not see her hair previously? Is this the reveal of the red hair?
It seems to be.
So she had even less information in chapter 10 than we thought she did.
They really do seem to keep their heads up most of the time.
And the nice hair comment as well. So I listened to it. I was reading it and listening to the audiobook simultaneously, and like the tone of voice that Quirk uses to say that is very distinct.
In what
It's
way?
like it's kind of like it's a little threatening. It's a little like secret whisper threatening in a way that I was like, this is weird given all of the behavior that you've just given shown towards this person. Like suddenly there's this other piece where
Nice
you're a bit
hair.
menacing.
She whispered archly. That kind of makes sense. So, okay, so if this is the reveal to her that this is Wake's child, potentially.
Or Gideon Prime's.
True. I'm so confused by what's happening in this book
Oh no, wait,
from Sif's
she knew about Wake.
perspective. She knew about Wake.
Okay. No, so that would make sense. Although I don't know if they knew that she used her own eggs, because that wasn't the original plan.
True.
It's so hard to know what anybody knows.
I need a, what's it called, Midnight Sun version of this from like literally any other character's perspective just to like cross-reference. I don't care who it is, it could be teacher.
Unfortunately, you get Silas, and it is a lot of
No.
braiding and washing.
And judging.
So much laundry.
Question. If your insides were being sucked out through a gigantic straw, I guess it's a two-part question. One, where do you think Gideon's insides are being sucked out from? And two, where would you prefer your insides being sucked out from if not from the same place that Gideon's? R-P.
I don't like
My
me.
instinct is belly button.
Yeah, I would
My instinct
also.
is also belly button.
Yeah, I think that makes
Oh.
sense.
Some people like belly button in interactions. Me, n never. Never. Never, 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 never. That is the worst option.
Yeah, I'm not saying I like it. I'm just saying that's where my mind goes to immediately. It's already got a little just like a Capri Sun.
Okay, so this actually raises another question. When you imagine Gideon's insides being sucked out through a straw, how thick is the straw?
Boba straw.
I
Boba
Because
straw.
I was imagining giant straw that she's
Oh.
feeling sort of full body, like she is the boba.
I was feeling like proportional boba straw, so like maybe like a little like a like that diameter maybe. I don't know
I
why
just,
that's proportional
whatever fits her belly button
boba
well. I hate this concept of
straw
proportionality.
to me. I just thought like what's gonna fit into a belly button really
Yeah.
neatly. A boba straw is like just the right size. Like a Capri Sun of boba. Which like honestly, you get like pre-made bobas in cans more often. I feel like actually like a Capri Sun style packet might even be a better way of
Yeah.
packaging it than I see it commonly.
I got boba in a can recently for the first time, and then I was like, wait, I'm gonna have to drink all the liquid and then suddenly start getting pearls at some point by surprise. And that I ended up just like kind of straining off the liquid because that sounded like a terrible experience to me.
Now I'm imagining like a Capri Sun that's like Cavalier juice.
Gross.
The juice.
That feels like an Iante art.
She is my favorite monster.
So as she is dying and suffering, and this goes on for three solid pages and then some on either side. This is, as you said, so long. Harrow stumbles. And I remember in first reading, this was maybe the most scared I had been so far.
Yeah. The tension in the scene is very intense.
Yeah.
And I think it's so interesting that we don't and we never really get any details about what Harrow's experience of this is. We don't know why she stumbled. We don't know what the puzzle was that she had to figure out to get the key out of the box. It's just something that's happening and we are all in Gideon's POV, which, we are all the time, obviously, but I feel like this is one of the more obvious points of like, we have no idea what's going on outside of Gideon is dying.
Yeah, they don't debrief this on Harrow's side.
Yeah. Which, fair.
Yeah. I don't think Gideon probably was super curious about, but I took like the slowness of her moving, given the stakes, how slow she's walking for most of this, and then the fact that she stumbled tells me that it is hurting the whole time for her as well. And it's not clear how bad, and it seems like it can't be as bad because Gideon is literally screaming without meaning to, and like you couldn't probably walk in that situation. But it seems like this was also a really, really bad experience for Harrow.
I feel like I could see it being physically painful for Harrow, or I could see it being requiring great concentration. Also, as an alternative, or like at some point, Cytherea like covers Gideon's mouth because she's like she has to concentrate. I could also see it being like she can hear Gideon screaming over there, and it's like fucking with her brain, and she's like panicking, or
I
maybe
think
all three. I don't know.
all of them for sure.
Yeah, and knowing that we've led to Harrow's stumble with like 2.5 pages of excruciating detail about pain. So it really sets up that tension and yeah, that question of like of why, and is that before or after when Kithare is really she stumbles on the way back. Yeah, so it's after Kithare is like most pointed kind of anxious rambling to kind of coach Gideon through
And when Taro stumbles, Gideon kind of like pushes a little bit more juice to her too, which might have helped her like go faster after. I don't know.
Why do you think that Kithrae was worried that Hera would break the key?
It's gotta be something about the puzzle, right?
What
That there's
is
something that maybe
Kithria know about the
requires.
puzzle?
Yeah. I mean, she was there when it was
Oh,
created.
Kithara, I think Kithara could tell anyone anything that they wanted to know about the puzzle, but she couldn't share the information about how to solve the puzzle box without explaining how she knows that.
Yeah, because she can't have been over there to look at it unless maybe somebody showed it to her when they were making it before they put it over on the other side. Yeah.
So I think this continues to enforce the theory that like this is a very anxiety-inducing experience for Kithaera. Like
Oh, yeah.
that is more of a tell than maybe she's offered so far at all in terms of like how the fuck would she know? Why would she be worrying about that?
Maybe
That
she broke the
seems.
key when she did it. Or I guess we still don't know if they had to do the challenges or not, but I feel like that would kind of make sense.
I think the challenges happen afterwards because you have to be a lictor to have the ability to do two coterminal
Oh
spells.
yeah, you're right. They had to be lictors to set it up. There was also the moment where Harrow just kept on putting her hand in and letting it do the thing and was so casual about it. And like Dulcie was laughing about it and it was just so chill. That moment to me is so like horror. That moment freaks me out so much. And it's just like, oh, this world is terrible.
The
I don't know why
realization
that's the one that gets me, but I'm just, ugh.
Harrow knows that the senescence field is going to eat away her clothing and does not take any of her clothing off for later.
I wrote that down too. That how many sets of special robes does she have? That's gotta be like valuable and expensive and special.
It's
Come on.
explicitly like multiple layers of embroidered, voluminous. Like,
Somebody
what
spent a
do
lot of time on that.
you? And she's extremely modest.
Yeah.
So wouldn't she want clothes for after the
Really
she
not thinking
seems,
ahead.
yeah, there's a real tunnel vision here.
Which honestly, that's characteristic. That makes sense. But wow.
Yeah, notable.
Yeah. I do like that Harrow is full on naked, Gideon is full on dying, and she is very, very carefully and in great detail studying Harrow's face. That's very Gideon to me.
Yeah. Gideon also gets very upset that Harrow touches her neck for non-intimate reasons.
Gideon also gets very upset that Dulcinea looks at Harrow.
Yeah, she does.
Oh, she can do that look at anybody?
Yeah.
She can just turn that on?
And I know, oh my God, I want to call you Beans the Fifth so bad. Isn't that so funny?
Nun Pod with Love, Grief is a podcast. Thanks for listening to it.